Iran test fires long-range ballistic missiles targeting mock enemy vessels during a major military drill. Another departure from the Trump administration. The health secretary steps down over the recent deadly violence at the Capitol. And Taliban militants kill at least 14 members of Afghanistan's police force in two attacks. And welcome to World News, coming to you from our international studios right here in Tehran. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. First story takes us right here to Iran this hour, where the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has held the second and final day of massive military exercises in central Iran. During the drills, the IRGC targeted and destroyed mock enemy vessels in the Indian Ocean with long-range ballistic missiles. The chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Baghari, said Iran does not intend to attack any country. However, he said the country's armed forces will respond with all its might in the shortest time if any adversary had malicious intentions towards the Islamic Republic. The first stage of the IRGC maneuvers kicked off on Friday by firing surface-to-surface ballistic missiles and operating bomber drones. The missiles are equipped with detachable warheads and are guided from outer space and are able to penetrate into the enemy's missile shield. Well, January 16th marks 5 years since implementation of the Iran nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, after the International Atomic Energy Agency confirmed that Tehran met the relevant requirements under the JCPOA. All nuclear sanctions were lifted by the United Nations, the European Union, and the United States. 5 years on, the Islamic Republic is under the heaviest sanctions ever. And except for Iran, none of the other signatories to the deal fulfilled their commitments.
On January the 16th, 2016, the International Atomic Energy Agency confirmed that Iran met the relevant requirements under the nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action.
I wanted to inform you that I have just now released a report confirming that Iran has completed the necessary preparatory steps to start the implementation of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action.
It was called the day the deal was implemented. The agreement, however, was reached in 2015 after 2 years of intensive diplomatic and technical negotiations between Iran and the P5 plus one group of countries. As part of the deal, the US, under then-President Barack Obama, pledged to also waive secondary American sanctions as long as Iran continued to abide by the agreement. The U.S. Treasury Department said foreign subsidiaries of American companies could do trade with Iran. The EU also announced that economic sanctions against Iran had been lifted. Nevertheless, it didn't take long for the European and American signatories to go back on their promises, despite the Islamic Republic fully honoring all its obligations under the deal, leading to a situation not changing for Iranians the way it was promised. On the first day of implementation, Washington imposed new sanctions on 11 companies and individuals over Iran's ballistic missile program. Obama's successor, Donald Trump, was no better. He pulled the US out of the pact in 2018, saying it was defective and one-sided.
I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
Since then, Washington has imposed a series of additional sanctions on Iranian entities and individuals, as well as foreign companies in Iran and a number of corporations outside the country that do trade with Tehran. These sanctions have squeezed the country economically and infuriated Iranians. 1 year after the US withdrew from the deal, Iran began the process of scaling back its nuclear deal commitments. The most significant move occurred in December 2020, when Iran's parliament passed a law dubbed the Strategic Action Plan to counter sanctions. It called on the Iranian government to raise the uranium enrichment level to 20%. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, supported the move. He also slammed the sanctions and stressed that the measures are imposed on a baseless animosity and have to be lifted right away. Iran has time and again argued that the scalebacks are in response to the failure on the part of the remaining signatories to meet their obligations, adding that the steps are reversible if other parties fulfill their commitments.
U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar has announced his resignation, citing last week's deadly siege of the Capitol by supporters of President Donald Trump. U.S. media say he has informed Trump of his decision in a letter in which he called the Capitol incident an assault on democracy. Azar also reportedly cited some successes of the administration, including the rapid development of COVID vaccines, but said the attack would tarnish those legacies. This is while the Trump administration has been heavily criticized for its dealing with the virus or the vaccine distribution strategy. Azar's resignation is the latest in a series of departures of presidential aides and cabinet officials. Well, FBI data shows people in the United States bought a record number of firearms in 2020. The FBI conducted nearly 40 million firearm background checks during the past year, almost 40% higher than the previous year. Estimates also suggest nearly 5 million Americans bought a gun for the first time in their lives last year. December saw the most gun sales as tension simmered over the November presidential election. Spikes in weapon buying were also reported following pandemic-ridden unemployment levels. American civilians are in possession of an estimated 434 million guns, more than one for every person in the country. Well, a dozen Afghan police officers have been killed in an attack on a police outpost in Herat province. Security officials say the nighttime attack was carried out by Taliban members who had infiltrated the post in the district of Gorian. The Taliban have claimed responsibility. In another incident, two police officers were killed in a roadside bomb attack that struck their vehicle in the capital, Kabul. This a day after 12 security men were killed in a blast in northern Afghanistan, also carried out by the Taliban. Violence has recently surged across the country, especially in the capital. This is while negotiators from the government and the Taliban are engaged in talks in Doha to reach a lasting peace. Well, the Palestinian territories are poised to hold their first parliamentary and presidential elections in the coming months, this being the first time in 15 years we've discussed the matter in our news review program.
Hello, and welcome to the news review. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has announced elections, the first in 15 years, to take place later this year. According to a decree issued by Abbas's office, the legislative elections will be held on May 22nd, while a presidential vote on July 31st. According to the decree, the election will take place in all Palestinian territories. Meanwhile, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has welcomed the announcement. It says it has worked in the past months to resolve all obstacles in the way of elections.
Hamas assure its extreme eagerness that this process should be successful to fulfill the benefits for the Palestinian people who have the right to choose their representatives. We worked in the past months to hammer down all obstacles so that we can reach this day, because we believe that the nation owns the custody and the people should choose their representatives.
The Hamas spokesperson stressed that the elections should be free or fair and transparent, in which voters can express themselves without pressure and restrictions. Palestinians' last parliamentary ballot in 2006 resulted in a landslide win for Hamas, but the rival Fatah movement later rejected the result and seized control of the West Bank. Ashraf Shannon is our correspondent joining us from Gaza to give us the latest on that, and Saad Nim, professor at political science at Bursa University, who joins us from Ramallah. Okay, Ashraf, over to you first. Fill us in on what is a monumental and perhaps very significant event that's going to take place the first in 15 years, and these are the elections. Tell us news from both sides, Hamas and Fatah.
Well, the significance of these elections that they come after many years, especially that during that time there was a rift between the rival factions, Fatah and Hamas. Palestinians, especially in Gaza, still skeptic about the success of such elections, especially amid the complex problems between Fatah and Hamas, and also there is a fear of an Israeli intervention that could torpedo these elections. And we also have to keep in mind that following Hamas's overwhelmingly winning the legislative elections in 2006, it was boycotted by Western countries, and also the siege on Gaza was imposed in a very hermetic way. And it remains to be seen if these elections were succeed. We have to also keep in mind that the last time the Palestinian factions were edging closer to elections, and that was in May 2014, Israel waged the war on Gaza and torpedoed the whole thing.
Well, Sutner, to begin with, tell us why you think the elections are taking place at this time.
As a matter of fact, for many reasons, the elections became due and very important. The first thing, it's because it's due because last elections we had for presidential elections, it was 2005, and for the parliamentary elections, it was 2006. So we are talking between 15 to 16 years last elections happened. And according to the Palestinian, supposed to be the constitution, it's supposed to be every 4 years as it happened. But the circumstances in Palestine was very difficult the last years, and that prevented the elections of taking place, and especially with the partition between Gaza and West Bank and Hamas and Fatah. The second reason, which is equally important, that it is important for the reconciliation between all Palestinian factions, and especially between Fatah and Hamas. The separation between Gaza and West Bank now is due to be ended by the elections, and the elections should bring up a new era between Fatah and Hamas, that they hope that the elections will bring up again a Palestinian leadership for the Palestinian government and the Palestinian Legislative Council, which would help a lot in the ending the partition between Gaza and West Bank, and the reconciliation between all Palestinian factions after these elections. And the third and important also reason is that the Palestinian felt that in the international community is asking the Palestinian also to have these elections, because they lost their authority over the years. Since there was no elections for quite a while, they need to make an elections to make sure that the Palestinian leaders who are maybe in connection with the international community asking for negotiations or asking for a Palestinian state to have the credibility of their authority by these elections, which became very important, especially with the European Union pushing quite hard. And apparently some talks with Biden administration even before he took place in the American administration, apparently they hinted to the Palestinian that they should have elections, and they should be a real representative to their people if they want to have a good relationship and to restart this relationship with the United States. So the Palestinian, on all these accounts, they needed this election, which became really very important also for the Palestinian people.
Thank you for that, Sadnam, professor of political science at Brzez University. Ashraf Shannon, many thanks, a correspondent there from Gaza. And that does it for our news review. Thanks for tuning in.
And continuing with more news this hour, turning to Uganda, where the Electoral Commission there has declared President Yoweri Museveni as the winner of an election disputed by his main rival.
Candidate Yoweri Museveni Tuhaburwa Kaguta, having obtained the highest number of votes in the election, and the votes cast in his favor being more than 50% of the valid votes cast at the election, the Electoral Commission declares Yoweri Museveni Tibuhaburwa Kaguta elected President of the Republic of Uganda.
According to the commission, Museveni has secured his sixth term in office with over 58% of the vote. The main opposition candidate, Bobby Wine, trailed with nearly 35%. The turnout was declared at over 57% of the almost 18 million registered voters. The Electoral Commission urged the population to remain calm and accept the outcome. Wine has accused Museveni of fabricating the results and called the poll the most fraudulent election in the history of Uganda. The pop star turned lawyer has urged citizens to reject the results. Well, the government shut down the internet a day before the election. The blackout is still in place. U.S. officials are warning that the new variant of COVID-19, which was first discovered in the U.K., could become the dominant variant in the U.S. by March. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the new variant, which is believed to be twice as contagious as the current version, will increase the burden on health resources. The new variant increases the percentage of the population that needs to be vaccinated to achieve protective herd immunity. 76 people have been sickened by the new variant in 10 U.S. states. And now to India, which has started the world's largest COVID vaccination drive with the aim of protecting its 1.3 billion population from the deadly disease. Prime Minister Narendra Modi launched a campaign addressing medical workers via video conferencing. Around 300,000 people will get the shots on the first day, starting with healthcare workers and people over 50. Officials hope that 300 million people would be inoculated by early August. Recently, the government approved the use of two vaccines. One of them is jointly developed by AstraZeneca and Oxford University, while another developed by local pharmaceutical firm Bharat Biotech. India is the world's second most infected nation, with more than 10 million coronavirus cases and almost 150,000 deaths. Meanwhile, Iran has registered 6,100 new coronavirus infections, its lowest daily caseload in nearly a week. The country's total infections stand above 1,324,000. The health ministry spokeswoman Seema Saadat Lahri also reported 96 new COVID-related deaths during the past day. Iran's death toll from the virus is nearly 57,000. Over 1,113,000 people have recovered. Now, the government imposed tight restrictions almost 2 months ago to stem the spread of the virus. It later extended the curbs to include lower-risk cities to sustain the fall in the number of infections and deaths. Well, the German Chancellor's Party, the Christian Democratic Union, has elected Armin Laschet as the new chairman, paving the way for him to succeed the outgoing leader. Laschet won a runoff vote against his conservative rival, Friedrich Merz, with 521 votes. His win will unify the divided party, along with its Bavarian sister party, the Christian Social Union, behind a new leader. Well, the two parties struggled to find a suitable successor after Angela Merkel said she would step down in September. She has endorsed Laschet, saying he had the tools to run for chancellor. The 59-year-old politician is the premier of Germany's most popular western states of North Rhine-Westphalia. He has vowed to make sure that the next chancellor will be from the CDU-CSU union. And with that brings us to the end of this World News edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
The article you're about to hear under the heading "A New Polio Vaccine Joins the Fight to Vanquish the Paralyzing Disease" has been authored by biomedical writer Amy Cunningham. Stay with us for more of Amy Cunningham's article. After decades of work and mass vaccination campaigns that have spared millions of children from paralysis, the world is close to wiping out polio, but a small number of outbreaks that have simmered in areas of low vaccination remain. And some happened after weakened virus and the oral polio vaccine, over time, moved around the community and regained the ability to cause disease. No other vaccines made with weakened live viruses have caused outbreaks of disease. To stamp out vaccine-derived polio outbreaks, the World Health Organization, WHO, has granted emergency use for a new polio vaccine. The oral vaccine got the go-ahead on 13th of November. "We are very, very enthusiastically looking forward to using this new vaccine," says medical epidemiologist Chima Ohobunwo of Morehouse School of Medicine at Atlanta, Georgia, who has worked on polio eradication in Africa for more than two decades. Along with continuing the crucial work of improving vaccination coverage in places where it is low, the new vaccine will hopefully take us to the finishing line of polio eradication. 8 years after the World Health Organization's 1980 declaration that the world was free of smallpox, the Global Polio Eradication Initiative launched to tackle polio. The disease was a promising candidate for eradication. An effective, easily administered, and cheap vaccine was available. And poliovirus, which naturally infects only humans, doesn't hang around in other animals in between outbreaks. Most people who become infected with poliovirus don't feel sick, while some have flu-like symptoms. But about 1 in 200 becomes paralyzed for life. In the late 1980s, wild poliovirus paralyzed more than 1,000 children each day, according to the Global Polio Eradication Initiative. Since then, thanks to widespread vaccination campaigns, cases have plummeted by more than 99%, and two of the three types of wild poliovirus have been eradicated. The last cases from type 2 and type 3 were reported in 1999. And 2012, respectively. Only wild poliovirus type 1 remains, and only in two countries. As of December 30th, 56 cases were reported in Afghanistan and 83 cases in Pakistan caused by type 1 poliovirus in 2020. Much of this progress has been possible because of the oral polio vaccine. "It's been the workhorse of the eradication campaign," says virologist and infectious disease physician Adam Laring of the University of Michigan School of Medicine in Ann Arbor, Michigan. "Immunization with the oral vaccine has prevented more than 13 million cases of polio since 2000, according to the World Health Organization. A big advantage of the oral vaccine, which is made of live but weakened poliovirus, is that it is not only protects against paralysis, it also can stop wild poliovirus from spreading in a community. Poliovirus moves from person to person when someone ingests water or food contaminated with a virus-containing stool. The oral vaccine prevents wild poliovirus from multiplying in the gut and being passed on. While the oral vaccine has nearly wiped out wild poliovirus, it has a vulnerability. Weakened poliovirus in the vaccine has genetic changes that keep it from causing disease. As vaccine virus multiplies in the gut, it can lose key genetic changes, bringing it closer to behaving like wild poliovirus. And altered vaccine virus can be spread to others and establish community transmission. Biologist Raul Andio of the University of California, San Francisco School of Medicine has said, "That can be a problem if not enough people have been immunized against polio. More than 80% of children need to be vaccinated to keep poliovirus from spreading in a community. The first vaccine-derived polio outbreak to be detected occurred in the Dominican Republic and Haiti 2 decades ago in areas with low vaccination. Today, vaccine-derived outbreaks are primarily found in Afghanistan and Pakistan and countries in Africa. Most of these outbreaks, which have been responsible for more polio cases in the last few years than the remaining type of wild polio virus, are linked to vaccine virus type 2. Vaccination campaigns, which had used an oral vaccine containing weakened versions of all three types of polio virus, switched to using a formulation with just types 1 and 3 in 2016. However, the way to stop a type 2 vaccine-derived outbreak is with an oral vaccine containing only the weakened type 2 virus. And that has sparked new outbreaks, researchers reported in Science in April. It is this vicious circle, Loring says. As of 22nd of December in 2020, there were 854 polio cases linked to the type 2 vaccine virus. Hence the quest for a new and improved poliovirus type 2 oral vaccine, one that kept the good parts of the original, but with tweaks to try to prevent problematic genetic changes. It's a wonderful vaccine, so we didn't want to change the characteristics that induce the body's immune response, Dr. Andino says. The only thing we wanted to do is prevent the reversion to a disease-causing virus. Poliovirus can swap pieces of its genome with related viruses called enteroviruses. So the researchers move the string of genetic letters the virus needs to make more copies of itself closer to the gatekeeper modification. That way, if the vaccine virus was able to ditch that modification by the way of a swap, it would lose this necessary string of genetic letters too and die out. Finally, the team tinkered with the enzyme that RNA viruses, including poliovirus, use to help replicate themselves. The enzyme is sloppy and can introduce a lot of genetic changes, Andio says. That's advantageous for the viruses, which are continuously trying to adapt to a new environment, he says. Andio and colleagues modified this enzyme in the vaccine virus to introduce fewer mistakes so the virus cannot evolve so quickly. The new oral polio vaccine was shown to be safe and to produce an immune response similar to that seen with the original vaccine in infants and children, researchers reported. The hope is that the modifications will slow the evolution of the new vaccine virus such that it can end the existing outbreaks without creating new ones. The vaccine-derived outbreaks are a significant yet surmountable hurdle to polio eradication, says Uhuru Bonyu, and science is helping. But the key to ending polio is very high vaccination coverage. Obstacles including war, migrating populations, difficult terrain, and lack of vaccine acceptance have created pockets of inaccessible children, he says. Reaching all children requires engaging community leaders, providing culturally sensitive information, and finding out how to meet other community needs, says Owabunmu. For example, whilst working in Nigeria, he and his colleagues made progress with nomadic populations. It meant sometimes combining vaccinating their children with vaccinating their animals. The nomads' cattle would be immunized against brucellosis and anthrax bacterial infections. Protecting the animals also protected the nomads from these infections, he says, and motivated their cooperation towards having their children receive polio vaccine, a win-win situation. Polio eradication has been a long journey, but we're getting close, Ohuwabunwo says. The new oral polio vaccine is another light in the tunnel.
Africa Today.
Industrial development is of critical importance for sustained and inclusive economic growth in African countries. South African President and African Union Chairperson Cyril Ramaphosa addressed a recent session of the African Union Summit on the African Continental Free Trade Area. He noted that the commencement of trading under this Free Trade Area Treaty on the 1st of January 2021 will boost industrialization.
Our treaty will boost intra-African trade. It will promote industrialization and competitiveness and contribute to job creation.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on the challenges of industrialization in Africa. In the second part of our show, we are asking and we are analyzing the failure by West African countries to launch their eco-common currency as planned in 2020. We are asking, is France sabotaging efforts to dump the CFA franc in West Africa?
Africa's industrialization challenges. Despite being the second most populated continent in the world, with a population of 1.2 billion people, Africa represented only 1.4% of the world manufacturing value added in the first quarter of 2020. The COVID-19 pandemic has worsened the situation, and this has impacted negatively on the industrial sector. Economic growth expected to fall to -3.3% in 2020 in sub-Saharan Africa, pushing the region into its first recession in 25 years.
The COVID-19 pandemic brought about disruption to global supply chains and forced a rethink of local manufacturing capability. This has created an opportunity for the African continent, particularly now that the African Continental Free Trade Agreement will be coming into effect from January. Speaking at an African Free Trade Agreement business forum in Kigali, Rwandan president said the agreement is expected to spur manufacturing in the continent.
This agreement is about trade in goods and services. These are the kinds of complex products that drive high-income economies. African workers adding value in Africa, services offered by African professionals using the latest technologies, manufactured goods that are made in Africa.
Now, the path towards industrialization in Africa, however, faces a myriad of challenges. To discuss this, we are joined by Joseph Otieno, a writer and an African affairs analyst. Thanks a lot for your time, Mr. Otieno. Now, why has Africa failed to industrialize despite being the source of a huge chunk of raw materials used in industrialized countries?
I think there are very many reasons, but mostly historical. I think Africa's challenge goes back to half centuries, considering that with the huge amount of resources that we do have, and we have always had over centuries, well, literally enslaved, and so therefore controlled over centuries. So we became the source for raw materials, and our people were never ever allowed to participate in the day-to-day management of their own affairs. In fact, until not so long ago, you know, we could not even become independent nation states. In a way, that's one. But number two, I think much more recently, no huge excuse, the challenge has been leadership in Africa.
Mr. Ochino there says that leadership is crucial if Africa is to industrialize. Well, Rwanda seems to be providing some leadership. This East African country banned second-hand clothes imports, mainly from the United States, in 2018. The ban was aimed at boosting its textile industry. Now, as a result, the U.S. ended Rwanda duty-free export privileges. Rwanda has insisted that the move to ban imports of second-hand clothes from the United States is meant to boost local industries.
We want to achieve two goals in the country. One of them is to really support the local producers, because they're there. We're not just opening up the market for them to do business. We also want to understand how we can make them competitive.
Mr. Ochieno, how have imports from Western countries been a major impediment to the development of African industries?
In the presence of decent and responsible governments, that should be regulated, and most regulations normally would be either through taxation or, if you like, conditional development.
Mr. Ochieno, you have spoken there about the need for proper government policies to stop unregulated imports from industrialized nations. Now, do you think lack of political commitment and the audacity to implement the right policies is an impediment to Africa's quest for industrialization?
Politics determines, you know, the trends around the world, whether it's in industry, in service, in security, and in everything else. I think, as far as Africa is concerned, there will have to be a nuanced and substantial change in terms of the political values on the continent. And unless and until we have and begin to have leaders who are not only democratically elected, but those that are accountable to the people, and those who know that after 4 or indeed 5 years of their term, whichever that is, first or second terms, they will be subjected to a critical rigor of their programs over that period of time, and so therefore they will have to present what my late president used to call the balance sheet to the citizenry. We will continue this way. So political will is lacking in many cases.
Well, Mr. Ochieno there believes that the lack of political will is a barrier in Africa's quest for industrialization. However, some countries have shown political will.
Ghana's president, Nana Akufo-Addo, is successfully implementing the One District, One Factory program. The aim is to change the nature of Ghana's economy from one which is dependent on import and export of raw material to one which is focused on manufacturing, value addition, and export of processed goods.
In partnership with the private sector, we'll establish one factory in each of the 216 districts across the country. One district, one factory.
A technology-savvy educated workforce is more important than ever in today's fourth industrial revolution. Rwanda's President Paul Kagame believes that quality education systems in Africa, especially in secondary schools, are critical for the continent's long-term development goals.
Africa's path to prosperity will be defined by the quality of our schools. And secondary school is the critical link that prepares young people to succeed in the workplace. This report sets out some key principles we need to take on board to adapt our secondary education systems for the future. Digital literacy, science, and technology have to be absolutely central because the world of work is going to continue to change in unpredictable ways.
Do African countries have enough technical know-how to effectively enter the fourth industrial revolution?
I think that is a very interesting question. As an African, as an African who believes that I have got sufficient capacity to think, and who's generally surrounded by not so uneducated Africans, I actually think, by and large, we've got the capacity to be able to do so. And again, as an African who travels across the continent and indeed the rest of the world, particularly in Western Europe and North America, I know Africans with huge capacity to compete at the highest levels. I think that is possibly not the issue. The issue is whether or not today our educational systems on the continent are geared sufficiently enough to train and to capacitate and to equip the young Africans, particularly the young graduates of the African continent, on the next set of skills in terms of equipping post, educational post, if you like, trainings with sufficient skills to compete in the global market. I think that part of it is a problem. The other thing, though, is that if we're talking, as we're saying, mashallah, Chinese investments and many other in terms of Western investments, you realize that many of these guys come with some of their own already substantially skilled at the top end of skills management. And in the case, therefore, you find that the African is generally very much confined.
Very well put there. Africans have the capacity to compete at the highest technical levels. Mr. Ocheno, at the start of our show, we heard about the African Continental Free Trade Area. How will this trade bloc boost industrial development in Africa?
Already, cross-border trade, in a very simplistic way, tends to be quite huge, because many of these cases about communities, even today, in my previous assignment and conversations and commitments, I was having conversations with people some of whom were having engagements from across the borders, more than a single border, in fact. So that is possible. The problem, though, is the volume of that trade, other than the informal element of the trade, the volume of the formal trade where you still find African countries subjecting their neighbors, in fact, in many cases, sister nations, to huge level of taxations, and there is still a huge amount of living in impediments that, you go to a neighboring country and forget about trade. You simply find that crossing the border to a neighboring country, you know, people queue for far longer than they would possibly try to seek for visas going to some of the established nations. I think there's still a huge problem.
Well, a lot more needs to be done in terms of putting the right policies in place for African countries to effectively compete globally.
Where is West Africa's echo currency?
The decision by 8 mainly Francophone West African countries to abandon the CFA currency that they have been using since before their independence from France was touted as the end of French stranglehold on the region.
At the end of 2019, Emmanuel Macron announced that France wanted a reform of the CFA franc. Two currencies, the West African CFA franc used in 8 West African countries and the Central African CFA franc used in 6 Central African countries. According to the current arrangement, these countries must deposit 50% of their respective foreign exchange reserves to the French Finance Ministry. Chiefs of the 15-nation economic community of West African states, ECOWAS regional bloc, said in 2019 the CFA franc will be replaced with the ECO in 2020. However, hopes to launch ECO currency have faded amid the coronavirus crisis and squabbling over severing the remaining monetary ties with the former colonial ruler, France. Speaking in June, Nigerian president cautioned his counterparts in ECOWAS bloc of possible dangers brought by ECO if not well thought out.
We cannot ridicule ourselves by entering a union to disintegrate potentially no sooner than we enter into it. We need to be clear and unequivocal about our position regarding this process. We must also communicate same to the outside world effectively. We have all staked so much in this project to leave things to mere expediencies and convenience.
Now, to get some insight on why the eco-currency failed to take off as expected, we have contacted Daniel Lazar, journalist and political analyst. It's good to have you with us, Mr. Lazar. Now, can you tell us, what's your take on the failure by West African countries to establish the eco-currency in 2020 as previously agreed?
There are a lot of reasons. I mean, first of all, these economies are very weak, and they're getting weaker due to the global recession since the pandemic hit. And so in the European common market, those countries grew together during a time of unprecedented economic boom. But what we see in Africa, in Central and West Africa, is the exact opposite. I mean, a deepening recession, and as the recession strikes, forces of disunity grow stronger. So therefore, the likelihood of them coming together behind some kind of common market and a common currency seem to be diminishing. So there's still a lot of talk, and the talk seems to be going nowhere.
Thanks a lot, Mr. Lazar, for that.
Despite statements, French President Emmanuel Macron appears not interested in ending the unequal and unfair relationship with countries that were colonized by his country in Africa. France continues to control the trade and currency of these former colonies. The maintenance of economic domination allows a prolongation of political domination. Is France involved in behind-the-scenes moves to prevent West African countries from having a new currency not tied to Paris?
I think France probably wants to maintain the CYA franc because, in general, it wants to keep a hand in those countries' internal affairs. But the war on terror, the international intervention in Libya has harmed those which France supported, of course, has harmed those countries immensely. I mean, the overthrow of Gaddafi in 2011 led to a huge spread of Libyan arms throughout the region and helped create chaos and subvert governments, you know, across the French-speaking area. So France's policies, not only its currency policies, but its broader policies in support of the global war on terror, have just wreaked enormous damage, have imposed enormous damage on those countries.
Mr. Lazarvier has pointed out that French policies have imposed damage on CFA franc zone countries. By the way, the lowest ranking countries in the 2019 UNDP Human Development Index, namely Chad, the Central African Republic, and Niger, are in the CFA franc zone. Clearly, reliance on France comes with a heavy price for these resource-rich countries. Mr. Lazar, why do governments in this region lack political resolve to disentangle their nations from French monetary imperialism?
Well, I'm just skeptical of any attempt to put all the blame on the currency question. I mean, I think that the currency issue is part of the problem, but the bigger problem is French foreign policy in general, the war on terror, which has actually led to more terror, more weapons, and more terror throughout the region, and the weak economies in Central and West Africa, and therefore the growing forces of disunion.
Thanks a lot for that, Mr. Lazar.
Money is an instrument of sovereignty for a state. But even 60 years after independence, the former colonies of France and Central and West Africa did not have it. Will a delay in rolling out the eco currency negatively impact on the economies of these African countries?
They've been talking about an eco for years. The African equivalent of the euro, but the preconditions don't exist, and those preconditions involve strong local economies and some kind of tendency to greater political union, and we just haven't seen that. I mean, first of all, the eco region is divided by language between French and English, and that creates growing problems. And secondly, the countries, while they talk about unity, all their actions are in the opposite direction. So the basis for a common ecozone that would be analogous to the eurozone in the EU I mean, just don't exist. And you can't regard currency as a kind of a, you know, a magic wand or an electric switch that you can flick on and off. You have to have, you know, years of political foundation laying before that is even possible.
While some countries in West Africa have expressed reservations on the single currency in the region, in June, Gambia President Adama Barrow addressed his colleagues in a virtual meeting. He said his country remains committed to the revised roadmap of the ECOWAS Monetary Cooperation Program.
I will emphasize here that the Gambia remains committed to the revised roadmap of the ECOWAS Monetary Cooperation Program. This commitment has been translated into sustained improvements on achieving the set of macroeconomic convergence criteria. Since 2017, the Gambia has constantly achieved three of the four primary convergence criteria, missing only the budget deficit criteria.
What needs to be done to speed up the establishment of the eco currency?
I mean, when you saw the establishment of a common market in Europe in 1948, I believe it was, the economies were growing, the countries were coming together in a new burst of democracy in the wake of the defeat of Nazi Germany. Strong democratic institutions were being developed, and those all came together to form a European common market, which eventually grew into the EU and the Eurozone. So you just can't turn these processes on and off like with a flick of a switch. You've got to lay a strong political foundation, and that's not happening. That would require a huge change in political circumstances. In Central and West Africa, it require basically a democratic revolution, and that simply is not taking place.
A strong political foundation is a prerequisite for a powerful monetary union in West Africa. That's Mr. Lazar's take on the path West African nations need to take if they are to achieve dreams of a common currency. Now that wraps it up for this edition of Africa Today. Thanks a lot. On behalf of the entire Africa Today team, I would like to thank you all. And until next time, it's goodbye from me and God bless you.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.